The Mysterious Circumstances podcast is hosted by Justin Rimmel. This is an American Crimecast production. Visit us at our new home at accproductions.org. Remember, everyone is innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Hi, I'm Nick.
And I am Rob, and we are the Brohio Podcast.
We cover all the unknown and much more.
Aliens, true crime, famous murders, monsters, paranormal, and everything that goes bump in the night.
We keep it funny, slightly trashy, and sometimes we like to talk about crapping our...
Nick, we are trying to make a good impression here.
Right. You can find us on all your favorite podcast apps.
We drop new episodes every Monday.
We are a member of the Bomb Pod Media Network. We'd love to talk to you on Instagram and Twitter at Brohio Podcast.
And the bros of Brohio do appreciate you listening.
We will see you on the dark side.
All right, welcome to Mysterious Circumstances. I am Justin. I am joined again by the fabulous co-host Brandy. I was gonna do like the next up to the stage, Brandy, but I didn't. So.
I know it's a stripper name. I know
it totally is. At least it's not Candy. But But yeah, before we get going, I do have to ask about Texas. How are you guys recovering from the weather down there?
We're kind of halfsies. So yeah. Half of Houston is doing very well, and that half is taking care of the other half.
Good.
That's not doing too well.
That's good.
You're still driving down the block and seeing a lot of debris from people's homes, and it's unfortunate, but we're all coming together and we're all helping each other out. So it's a blessing.
That is fucking awesome right there. That's what it's all about. For all those people who hate America, that right there is what it's all about. All right. Today I'm going to go ahead and say a couple things before we get started. First of all, for those of you who listened to my question and answer episode, I was not talking shit about podcasts who use scripts. 99% of them do. I listen to all of them. And for those of you who do not know, when I am on American Crimecast, I am scripted. So, take that as you will. I was not talking shit about them. I was just saying that is not really my personal thing that I do. Go ahead and laugh, Brandy, but I got comments about that. So, I cannot win, basically. I can't win. But that, and I'm going to go ahead and put out a disclaimer. This case is pretty fucking sad, and it involves children. So, for those of you who are squirmish with details, you know, all my regular listeners know I am a stickler for details, and unfortunately I do not leave anything out, and that includes stuff like this. So, just gonna go ahead and say that before we get going. And, I don't know, Brandy, you want to go ahead and get us started?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Okay. So today we're going to go over the Bennett family murders, and this happened in 1984. This was in Aurora, Colorado, and the family that we're going to be talking about, the father's name is Bruce Bennett, and this is a young family. He was only 27. His wife, Deborah Bennett, was 26. And they had two baby girls, Melissa Bennett and Vanessa Bennett, ages 7 and 3. Bruce Bennett was in the Navy, and so he definitely was a protector,
mm-hmm.
a protector of, of the U.S. and a protector of his family. And he was actually also trained as a traffic controller. This particular morning, well, let me take it back to the evening before, because they're not quite sure about time frames, but mm-hmm. January 15th, approximately 9 p.m. to possibly January 16th, the morning of January 16th, in this Aurora home, basically there was an intruder that came in, And I'm assuming because the case shows that Bruce Bennett met him in a stairway or hallway area, he was attacked first. And from what I understand, he should have been dead by the first couple of blows.
Yeah.
And yeah. should not have survived. But this guy fought with all his might to protect his family.
Oh, my God, did he?
Yes.
Yeah,
just everywhere. And anybody can imagine getting hit with this. It's a hammer.
Yeah.
You know, I can't even imagine. But this guy fought from room to room. He didn't go down easy. Go down easy. To protect his family, and he was ultimately killed, blunt force trauma. I believe that there was also a knife involved.
Yes.
That was all. Yeah. So he fought really, really hard. Deborah, his wife, also was killed with the hammer. She was sexually assaulted.
Yes.
So not only did this guy break in, have this horrific murder, just like killed this guy. He's probably just covered in blood himself just from Bruce. Goes in, finds Deborah, kills her, rapes her, and then goes on to Melissa, I believe the 7-year-old,
yeah.
and she was sexually assaulted as well.
Yeah.
And she was... The thing is that Melissa was nearly 8 years old. She was 7, and they had just had like her birthday party like that weekend
yeah.
before. So she had celebrated her 8th birthday, but she hadn't turned 8 yet. And so she was sexually assaulted, hit on the head, hit, you know, with this hammer. I mean, just blunt trauma to everywhere. And then Vanessa was 3. Now Vanessa, she received blunt trauma as well, and she survived.
Yes.
Which is absolutely amazing. Now, so that everybody kind of gets the setting, Justin, you said you had some of the weather that they were having that night?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'm going to backtrack real quick. This did happen on January 16th. So this was pretty fucking cold in Aurora, Colorado. The weather conditions for that day, let's see, it was on a Monday, and there was no snow on the 15th, and the temps at night were below freezing, and the wind chill was actually at pretty much historical lows. It was extremely brutally cold. It should be known that there was no forcible entry found, and some of the details that Brandy touched on a little bit. They believe that did happen between 9 p.m. and 6 a.m., the 15th and the 16th. Now, Bruce was stabbed, slashed, and beat with a hammer, and his throat was eventually cut. This guy, after all of this, was the very first one to be attacked. He fought this attacker from room to room and up the fucking stairs to protect his family. They said there was blood everywhere. I don't say that lightly. The only reason I say that with any bit of confidence in my voice is because this fucking guy was amazing. He was amazing. He was fighting for his family. Deborah was bludgeoned with that hammer. She was 26 years old. She was also raped. And like Brandy said, Melissa Bennett, who was 7, was also raped and beat to death with the hammer. And I did read in one place that she was also stabbed, but I only read that in one place out of many. Now, Vanessa, I don't know why. I think he, at the end of the day, I'm pretty sure he thought she was dead. Her entire face was shattered, and that includes her jaw was shattered so bad there were bones of her jaw in her windpipe. But that little girl did live. Constance, who is Bruce's mother, was the one who found the bodies in the late morning of January 16th. The reason she went to the house was because they had a family furniture store, and Bruce had failed to show up for work, you know, didn't call or anything like that. So she went over to the house to check on everybody, and she found the scene that was, she, in her own words, the most traumatic thing she's ever experienced in her life, which is totally understandable.
Now, I looked up the proximity between, you know, where he was working and where the house was.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was pretty quick. You know, she could just kind of run over and go check and see, because this was not a norm for them to not show up. And, you know, there's some close by highways near their neighborhood. So it was just a matter of whoever did this just hopping in their vehicle or whatever means of transportation. I can't imagine it was any public transformation. Transportation. But there's a highway that's real close by, and he could have been long gone by the time everything was found.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit about the weather, and assuming that he took his own vehicle to do this, and the fact that there was no forced entry, I kind of think back in the day, in 84, maybe late 70s, I'm not sure if everybody even locked their doors. So maybe that's why they didn't find that there was a forced entry.
Well, that cul-de-sac there was still under construction. They were still building a shitload of houses, and I'm pretty sure their house was one of the first that was in that addition. So I'm pretty sure they didn't even have very many neighbors.
Yeah, so it was like kind of like an opportunity to, you know, here's this family that's living in here, and there's not much around them at the moment. But my thing is that this person, let's say they drove over, it was freaking freezing. And I know up north, you got to warm up your vehicle before you get going, especially, you know, those old school cars. So this guy had plenty of time to really think about it.
He did too.
Think about what he was going to do. And maybe fantasize or whatever's going on in his dude's head.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. And he, evidence wise, it's really sad. The one damning piece of evidence that probably could have helped this case was not released to the public until 2015, which 31 fucking years later. Now, I'm just going to go ahead and throw this out there. There are over 1,400 unsolved homicides in Colorado alone. Now, from what I understand, the police around that area, unless people confess, their success rate of solving shit is not very fucking good. And I'm not, well, I mean, I guess I kind of am bashing them. But they, evidence-wise, there was a footprint on the piece of concrete, I believe, either outside or in the garage. I'm not 100% sure where it was. But they removed that from the concrete, and they ended up getting fingerprints off of it as well. There was this dude's DNA all over the fucking house. Deborah's purse was found out in the front lawn. Most of the shit that was inside the purse was strewn out. Nothing was missing, though. So, you know, that kind of, you know, throws the robbery out the window a little bit. And the severity of the attack alone, there's no fucking way that this guy was a cat burglar. You know what I mean? Or something like that. I understand, like, that's might be a popular theory, and we'll probably touch base when we start getting into the facts of some of the other events that happened within that 12 days. There's a little 12-day window where some shit happened, but this dude pretty much just fucking disappeared off the face of the earth. Nobody reported anything. Now, the piece of evidence that I did touch base on, what it was on Melissa's pajama top. Upside down, you can see in blood the imprint of what would be like a fuzzy embroidered tag like you would see on a uniform. Now, they don't know if it was a name or the name of a company, but all they can really kind of make out, they've sent it to two separate labs to try to decipher, and it looks like it was either Richard, like R-I-C-H-A-R, which would be, you know, like Richard or whatever, or, you know, PETAW-C. Now, her pajamas were kind of folded over a little bit, so they don't think they got the whole word in there. Obviously, we looked into some other stuff, you know, with utility companies, railroad workers, blah, 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 in that area. You know, we're going to save that for the facts and theories area. Is there anything else that you wanted to touch base on in this Bennett attack?
Yeah, just real quick. I mean, there was so much blood in the house that I would imagine in 1984, it would have been very difficult for investigators to basically decipher through all the blood in the house, because we can't think that this guy walked away without some sort of scratch. I'm sure these people, I mean, they were fighting for their lives for each other.
Especially the fight Bruce put up.
I just think that there's got to be, there just has to be some DNA or something that we could do now that we have the technology and can identify it a little bit better.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine what this murder scene looked like. And I can't imagine that any police officers were prepared.
Yeah.
You know, for something like that.
Yeah. And what they ended up doing was they saved that DNA. What they do, what it's called, is called a snapshot composite. And this is an image based on DNA predictions. Now, this can predict hair color, eye color, origin of descent, which would mean like your ethnicity or something like that. It can even go and it can, you know, predict your freckling, you know, on your body or your face. Now, Parabon Nano Labs in Virginia is what does this, and it's referred to as DNA phenotyping or phenotyping. I'm not sure how to pronounce that word. I think it was right around 2000. I don't know. It might have been 2002, because in 2002, it should be known that the DA, the former DA at the time, did put out an arrest warrant for a John Doe. Now, his name was in June. This was in June 2002, and it was Jim Peters who did that. So that basically means
I thought it was absolutely brilliant that he did that.
Yeah, he did, and that is like very, very clever, because that basically means that as soon as this guy's DNA is matched, this guy's going to prison for fucking murder. Like, no pass go, no collecting $200, no bail money, no nothing.
Right, exactly.
And they did that after, you know, they had gotten the DNA evidence. Now, like I said, I'm not exactly thrilled about the police department waiting to release that one bit of evidence until 2015. The reason they said is because they didn't want to jeopardize the case. Now, from the looks of shit, Brandy, they really didn't have much of a case, okay? Not trying to be, like, overly critical here or anything like
that.
But they really didn't know shit. Now, the most interesting thing, I guess, if you're ready to move a little bit forward past the Bennetts, or should I say before the Bennetts, was that this DNA was matched to another hammer attack.
And yes, that was another hammer attack.
Yep, and that was one of three other attacks, possibly more, in that area. And the main one, which was the only other one to cause death, was Patricia Smith. Do you want to touch base on Patricia Smith a little bit?
Yeah, so Patricia Smith lived in Lakewood, Colorado, which if you map it is, to me, it looked like it was probably about a 45-minute or maybe 30-minute drive away from Aurora. So it wasn't too, too far away. It did occur on January 10th. So I'm not 100% sure if this was like his first trial run or have, you know, what was going on with him. Patricia Louise Smith was 50 years old, and she lived off of West Bayard, I believe, Avenue.
Yeah.
And I saw that she was in a, like, I guess that subdivision has like apartment numbers. So it showed that she was in an apartment, but we all have different definitions of apartments. So it might've been like a town home style or something. It's believed that the killer didn't know any of the family members, didn't know any of the victims, or wasn't connected to anybody. It just seemed like it was like an opportunity. And he didn't force himself into the home, is what I read on hers. So again, it might just be a means of kind of walking around and seeing whose homes are open. They do believe robbery is a possible motive, but for the most part, I mean, no, I don't think that for a second. I read somewhere that maybe something was missing, but you know, but that was it.
This was
the hammer. This is the one where I read that the hammer wasn't found, and I think you read on this one that the hammer was found.
Well, I had read both things, and this was actually on January 10th, which was, I believe, you know, 2 days before the Bennetts were killed. And the only reason they linked these two was because of the DNA and the hammer, obviously. But yeah, Patricia Smith was also raped, and she was found by her mother. They believe the crime happened between 1 and 3 p.m. She was found partially clothed. And I had read, like you had said, two different things. I had read that the hammer was gone. I read two totally different things in more than one place, so it's like extremely confusing. Yeah. I read that the hammer was gone, so it was possibly the same hammer used, but I also heard that the attack was so brazen because the killer or the attacker left the hammer laying beside Patricia's half-clothed body. So it's really hard to, you know, determine which one is true, because I mean, I consistently read both things in more than one place. So
but you know, for me, I think it would make sense if the hammer was indeed there, because in the different stories, they're kind of linking these things all through, and sometimes they're saying he's bringing the hammer, like he's bringing his own murder weapon, and sometimes he's leaving it, and you only know if he's using a new hammer if you know what one of them is, like, unless there's some sort of identifying marks in the injuries that would tell you that it's a different hammer every time.
Yeah.
So,
and I think the only thing on
100% sure.
Yeah, the only thing on the head of a hammer would be sometimes the faces aren't smoothed over. Sometimes they're a little bit serrated, but it's hard telling. It was so inconsistent, that fact was, and it really bothered me because I was trying to find articles that said more, leaning towards more one than the other, and I couldn't. It was literally 50-50 right down the middle with all the stuff I read. But I did keep reading that it was different hammers, and if that was the case, then the hammer had to have been left by her body. Now, the weather conditions were actually about the same on January 10th. There was no snow. You know, the temperature was from anywhere from 16 degrees to the low 40s. There was no snow the previous day. The previous day was a little bit warmer, I guess. It was in the 20s and stuff. So, I mean, weather conditions aside, and there's a reason I'm saying these weather conditions. So just remember that stuff. We're going to get to that and some of the theories and all that good stuff. But
what I understand, there was construction going on around her residence as well.
Yes, there was. Yes, there was. There was a new development, just like where the Bennetts lived. So there was a lot of houses going up. There was a lot of utility companies putting in furnaces. There was plumbers. You know, there's a lot of traffic, but still no witnesses to anything. And they believe the attack happened between 1 and 3 p.m. You know, that's...
Yeah.
You know, it's really hard to believe.
That blows my mind, too.
You know, and then her poor mother, you know, had to walk in to find that, you know. And I mean, don't get me wrong, her mother is probably, if Patricia was 50, her mom's probably at least 70. Christ, she's like, she didn't have a damn heart attack or stroke or something.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. Now, those are the cases in which someone died. And was murdered. But there's actually a couple of incidences that happened January 4th of 1984 where individuals were attacked and they were not killed. They actually survived.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing to me that there wasn't enough evidence at that time or enough description of who the attacker was. And it just seems so strange that these people were brutally attacked, survived, and still we don't have any information.
Exactly.
So on January 4th, 1984, an intruder attacked James and Kimberly. Now you're going to have to help me with this last name.
I believe it's called Haubenschild Child. It's H-A-U...
Okay, what he said.
Yeah, H-A-U-B-E-N-S-C-H-I-L-D. I think it's Haubenschild. But yeah...
From what I understand, they were attacked at home as well.
Yes. Yes, they were.
And it was a fractured skull, concussions, various injuries, again, with the hammer.
Yep. I mean, both of them survived. And again, on that same day, a man with a hammer attacks a woman named Donna Dixon, who was a flight attendant. She was in her garage, and it left her in a coma. So I imagine he probably thought he killed her. She ended up surviving, and she still is very, very active about getting this case solved. She is very, very loud about it, which is awesome. But the Bennett family ended up being the last of the attacks, which, in all honesty, were the most brutal. And I find it interesting that on the last attack that was the most brutal was the only one that he took the knife with him. So there was no sexual assault of Donna Dixon that I could find at all.
Right.
You know, it's... I will say this, though. Kim Haubenschild, she did have a concussion, but she stated that she saw the assailant. What she said she saw was, like, an African-American male, well over 6 foot tall, and very well built, so a very big guy, which a couple swings of a hammer of a dude that size, I can't really see somebody just having a concussion, you know what I mean? Like, not to be morbid about it, but for God's sakes, you know? Now, that totally contradicts the DNA, you know, what do they call it, the snapshot or whatever. The DNA snapshot describes a white male of European descent who was, you know, 5'10", 5'11", maybe 180 pounds. I will post a picture of him on the Facebook page in the group so you can see that picture. It's actually really, really interesting how they pulled that technology together to do that. It's pretty fucking amazing. But other than that, there were a couple random attacks days earlier as well, on the Highline Canal in the Alameda Avenue corridor. Some of the details of those I really couldn't find. Did you happen to find anything on any details on them?
It was very, very limited.
That's okay. Yeah, so...
Which, it might have been that those attacks indeed happened, but he just wasn't successful at it, and he was leading up to what was coming.
Yeah. The thing about it was before January 4th and after January 16th, nothing. It's like this guy came out of nowhere, then the guy left. The brutality of the Bennett family, which was the last of the attacks, and the only one that he carried a knife on, you know, kind of tells me that he was on a mission. And usually, shit like that, somebody like, I'm not a fucking FBI profiler, but I don't think a person who does that kind of shit can stop. You know what I mean? So, we'll touch base, you know, more on that, I guess, in some of the theories and stuff, but it's just very, very interesting because it's like the guy just fucking disappeared. He, like, appeared out of nowhere, attacked a shitload of people with a fucking hammer, murdered almost an entire family, and then just vanished into thin air. And that's with literally leaving fucking DNA everywhere. It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Unbelievable. But,
yeah, I mean, we were going through a couple of theories, you and I, and as soon as we would come up with one, we'd almost discount it in the same sentence. I can't imagine being an officer at the time trying to figure that out either.
Yeah, it's, that's the real head-scratcher, is pretty much every theory is almost immediately dismissible. It's honestly confusing, and it's sad at the same time because Constance Bennett, Bruce's mother, is still alive, and she's still very, very active in this case as well. Very active. But I guess with that, unless you have anything to add, I guess we can move on to some little side facts that I suppose people might want to know.
Yeah, absolutely. One of them that I kind of thought was interesting was Donna Dixon being attacked in the middle of the day in her garage, of all places. Mm-hmm. So just kind of knowing the neighborhood, or, you know, the type, there was movement there. I mean, yes, there was construction, but there was people there that were there during the day, you know, within that community and with the active construction going on during the day, because they couldn't work at night.
Yeah.
So I don't quite understand how there wasn't anybody that saw, heard, you know, I don't get it. And especially with it being in a garage.
Exactly.
A garage that's not tucked behind anything. Yep. It's, you know, that was shocking to me.
It was. And like I had touched base on the weather conditions a lot, because a lot of people are really suspecting that it was possibly a construction worker. But the thing about it was the hours of it happening. Monday was between possibly midnight and 6 a.m. That was on a Monday, January 16th. You know, it was freezing outside, like historical lows, and just brutally cold wind chill wise. The January 10th attack on Patricia was on a Tuesday. You know, no snow. Like I said, temperature ranged from 16 to low 40s. Not many construction workers are going to be outside working. And I mean, I understand you can acclimate, you know, to say like Colorado weather and stuff like that. But even the January 4th attacks, those were during the day as well. And that was on a Wednesday. And Patricia Smith and the other two attacks on the 4th were in the middle of the day. In January 4th, there was no snow as well. It was well below freezing at night. But during the day, I will say it was in about the 50s. But if the guy was working construction, he's obviously going to be working. Now, there is another interesting side fact that could possibly play into some of the theories. And I do got to give a big shout out to Melinda in Colorado Springs, who helped me out with this. She went to bat for me on the ground, and she called around quite a bit. And I appreciate that immensely. But because here's some side facts that are tied into this. The Bennetts had a family furniture business, and Patricia Smith was also, it just started a home decor business. So there's a possible link that this was a person who was possibly a drywaller or a plumber of some sort, or some kind of inside construction trade that would grant him access to the houses, to where he would have knowledge of the people inside and have, like, maybe some kind of formulated attack. You know, not obviously not too formulated, but there was a utility company that was called Aurora Plumbing, and it's called APC Plumbing now, and they did do plumbing and furnace installations in that development that the Bennetts lived in. They also did some work in the Lakewood area where Patricia Smith lived in 1984. Now, that theory does hold a little bit of ground, but that doesn't explain Donna Dixon and the Hobbins child couple, because the Hobbins child, I could not find their occupation, but Donna Dixon was a flight attendant. So there's some of those facts, you know. It's just, you know, I found that out, and I was sitting there, and I found out that they were both into some kind of home business, and with all the development and construction going on and stuff like that, I was like, fuck, I found a connection. I solved it. And I was all excited because I messaged you. I was like, I think I found a connection. And then I was like, ... shit, never mind. Donna Dixon was a flight attendant. It's like, I ain't solving shit today.
That's a great linkage that you put together, because then I mean, we were all kind of thinking of the trade. Okay, so aside from the blood evidence on the PJs, the fact that it's a hammer is pretty industry specific. It wouldn't regularly be the tool of choice, I would think, amongst killers.
No.
Because it's going to make a huge mess. Like, I don't even know how you move on to the next person, because you're slipping and sliding all over the place, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that blows my mind that the hammer was the weapon of choice. And you've got these trades that you kind of look at and you go, okay, well, maybe he was a plumber. Okay, maybe there was some construction going on in there. And you're thinking about it and you're thinking, okay, but the people that survived, we were talking about this earlier, the people that survived, they didn't give any distinct indications or characteristics of this person, the people that were able to give any kind of description.
Yeah.
So usually in the trade, anybody that's going to use a hammer usually works with their hands, let's say. And if they work with their hands might be coarse or, you know, if it's somebody that works, you know, on the railroad, it might be somebody that smells like oil or some sort of lubricant. And then you've got, let's say, the construction industry, there's, you know, different chemicals or tools. There's just different attributes to that you would indicate, you know, this person came in and smelled like this.
Yeah.
Or something to confirm that they're with the trade, yeah. Which honestly, it just seemed a little strange to me. I mean, their hands are going to be coarse. If they're working with their hands, there's going to be, you know.
Definitely.
I mean, I don't know.
I mean, I could see.
People were knocked out, so.
I
get it.
And that's the thing with the DNA profile or the DNA snapshot. I keep wanting to say Snapchat. I'm not even going to lie. With the DNA snapshot, it's like. Granted, it's not 100% accurate, and it's never fucking gonna be, but with DNA, it is a provable science, alright? In the description that Kimberly Hobbinschild gave is totally contradictive to that DNA, so you always have the possibility of maybe that DNA was picked up from possibly a construction worker that had worked there. Or maybe Kimberly was not telling the truth, or I don't know why she would fucking lie about it, to be perfectly honest with you, but, you know, let's be real. She got knocked the fuck out. She got hit pretty hard in the head with a damn hammer. So,
well, one of the reasons why somebody might not tell the truth when given a description is because they've threatened them beforehand. Like, we can think that he probably thought that he killed her.
Yeah.
But if he says, I'm coming after you and your family, you know, and that's going to stay in her mind, and then she survives, she's going to give the opposite description of this white Caucasian DNA
that's totally
that she
true.
Found. It might have happened. I don't know.
Well, and the fact that this DNA linked two crimes in separate towns with the same weapon is kind of hard to dispute. You know what I mean? It really is.
Right.
And I'm not... trying to say, you know, Kimberly is a liar or whatever, but you can't dispute, you know, cold hard facts. It is what it is. And that's literally the only reason they linked these two together was because of that. Because the severity of the crimes, I mean, I'm pretty sure the only reason they knew it was a hammer with Patricia Smith was because I personally believe, even though I read both things, I read that it was a different hammer used in each attack, and the only way they would know that is if the first hammer on January 10th with Patricia Smith was left at the crime scene beside the body.
Right.
I don't know. Is there any other facts that you could really dig up?
We kind of touched on that attorney that did the warrant for the John Doe.
Yeah, Jim Peters.
You know, just to link it to the DNA. And I thought that was an absolutely brilliant move to put it into CODIS because, I mean, chances are this guy's long gone, okay? But if by some reason he resurfaces, you know, that'll always be in there, and then they'll be able to press, you know, the charges for the murders, charges for the rapes and entries, and, I mean, you just name it. They could just, you know, lay it on them nice and thick. But, again, let's kind of cover up the him actually showing up out of nowhere and then leaving out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So I was kind of thinking initially when I heard about it was that maybe – he was in jail and he was paroled or something. Like, he came out of nowhere, and you don't just kill people with a hammer on your first go around.
No.
I don't think that's where you start. So, so it felt like maybe this was some built up dream or fantasy of his that maybe, you know, he gets out, he's able to go and kill, and either he goes back into prison for some reason, or maybe he just flees the country altogether. Yeah. I don't know how difficult it, or easy it would be to get out of the country in 1984.
It'd be a lot easier than it is now, if I can tell you that much.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, too, is with the hammer, why not just use a gun? This guy, I want to say it's almost personal, but the attacks were spread out over that 12-day window, and it was people who seemingly were not connected. So it's like he had something built up inside of him. Like you said, he came out of nowhere. The vehicle, there's no fucking vehicle, no witnesses, no nothing. Somebody had suggested, I read one theory, that he possibly used public transportation. Not trying to rain on anybody's, like, web sleuth fucking theory here, but if I saw a dude get on a fucking bus after, like, the Bennett attack, dude, there's no fucking way this dude was not carried. He fucking carried Melissa's body. I don't know to the to what extent, but at some point in time, he had her body over his shoulder to get that imprint of it. So it's like this dude legit had was covered in fucking blood, and he just fucking vanished. Nobody saw anything. I heard railway worker, because there was a lot of, you know, railways coming and going through the area at the time. But then again, you have to think coworkers, you know. Somebody saw, you know, it's like, hey, this guy disappeared for X amount of time. You know, we don't know where he was. You know, all that good shit. It's like, you can't just disappear out of thin air with fucking blood all over you.
I just think that, you know, that whole theory about, well, I don't want to say theory, because the witness said that it was a tall African-American man. I don't really know what the dynamics of the neighborhood were, but the fact that there were no witnesses makes me feel like this is someone that fit in to where this family lived. And from what I understand, this entire family was Caucasian.
Yeah.
So I don't know if maybe... I just don't see how that all works together. I mean, if you see someone that's, you know, kind of a taller gentleman, it's going to be more noticeable than, you know, somebody that just looks like the average guy from down the block, you know? So maybe they don't notice a car, or, you know, they don't notice anybody get into anything because they never noticed him. I don't know.
Yeah, or even going along with he was some kind of tradesman. He was supposed to be in that area. He was supposed to be in that house because he was, you know, installing furnaces, doing plumbing, doing drywall, or something of that nature, like some kind of service technician or some shit. I just...
Right.
It's honestly really perplexing just because, I mean, the guy, you know, disappearing out of nowhere, there's a lot of different ideas. Like, one of them would be he went to prison. At that point in time, I don't think they did DNA as people are going into prison like they do now. So there could be a fucking guy sitting in prison for an unrelated charge, or went to prison for an unrelated charge, that killed, you know, four fucking people and attacked the shit out of some more and just got off, you know. Or some people say that, you know, after the attack of the Bennetts, where he just, like, frenzied, he got scared and just skipped town, just freaked out. And I think that was your suggestion, actually, when we were talking. And it's just, it seems likely, I mean, because he just got so freaked out, but he just evolved, you know, from seemingly little hammer attacks to the Bennett family shows up with a hammer and a knife and just tries to kill an entire family. And it's just unbelievable.
Right. And, you know, I mean, this is back in the day when, you know, you could get a plane ticket, you get a train ticket, you could get a bus ticket, and you're paying cash. Nobody cares. It's just a voucher to get on, you know.
Exactly.
And it's not a big deal. No one's tracking your movements or anything like that. So, but the thing that's weird is that a crime like this, and as horrific as it is, that sickness doesn't leave you.
No.
I think once you're that messed up in the head, you know, you're gonna be that way. So I don't know if there were other cases that were similar to it and maybe just haven't been tied together. Yeah. That it seems to me just unheard of that he's going to go from this extreme and then just completely stop. Like,
yeah.
Something happened to him. And that's what made me think that possibly he had left the country. Because maybe police departments in the U.S. can talk to each other, and, you know, we all have the internet and we can tie it together now. But back then, and who's to say that he didn't, you know, go down to Mexico or go up to Canada or even go, you know, overseas altogether?
Yes.
And, you know, this killing spree continued. We just have no way of knowing.
Yeah. Because, I mean, like you, like we had both said, it gradually got to the point of that attack on the Bennett family. And it's once you get to that point, there's no turning back. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a really sad case. And, I somebody like this ain't going to just stop. You know, I think there are other attacks out there. I'd like to just see, I don't know, there's got to be other cases out there that are tied to this one somehow, because...
And you know what struck me when I was first reading it? Because the hammer thing, I just can't get over the hammer. It's like kind of like one of those tools where it's gonna be so horrific when you kill them, kind of like a machete would, or, you know, or some other industrial tool. It seemed almost as if that it would be something that would be like a foreign way to kill somebody. Like, that's just not your average way. Either somebody takes out a knife, someone takes out a gun, you know, it's just kind of like, I don't want to get dirty kind of thing, you know, where this was just, how do you go from murdering and then the excitement of it and raping, you know, it being this hammer. I can't wrap my mind around the damn hammer. I just can't.
Yeah, it makes no sense, because why not just use a gun? Like, it was personal, or he was just had anger, you know, built up or something. And then, like you had touched on the rape, he went from raping a 50-year-old woman to a 26-year-old woman to a 7-year-old girl. And then I think what happened, I don't know. Part of me thinks that the fight that Bruce put up kind of freaked him out a little bit, you know, because he's like, shit, you know, that dude was supposed to be dead. And they straight up said the injuries that Bruce had, he should not have been alive after the initial attack of this guy. He was stabbed, slashed, beat with a hammer, his throat was cut, but he still fucking fought tooth and nail through the entire house on two different floors, trying to warn his wife and protect his family. And it's just like, I think that got to the killer to the point where it might have freaked him out a little bit. Like, fuck, you know, I'm not.
Yeah, I don't think he was anticipating that.
No, I don't think he was either. I think it was a pretty big surprise for old boy, you know, just like, fuck, you know, I need to go. But it's just, there's no reason for the attacks to stop other than possible death, suicide, incarceration, or just leaving town and going somewhere else. I don't know. There's pretty much the facts and theories all rolled into one, I guess. Is there anything else? I really don't. I mean, the theories wise, like everything we talk about, it doesn't add up.
Yeah. It doesn't add up. But no, I think we've pretty much covered everything, and it's just so sad what all of these families have gone through and continue to go through, because even though they're survivors, there's also, you know, all the family that loved them and the potential of the people that they could have been. And it's unfortunate that that was taken away from them.
Yeah, especially the young lady, Vanessa, who, you know, I don't want to say I feel thankful or happy that she doesn't remember it, but she has the scars. Right. She has the scars. She went through several reconstructive surgeries. Literally, her entire face was shattered. And she was raised by her grandmother. So I just hope she's out there doing good, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And what a powerful, powerful little girl.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, pretty much. But do you have any other closing thoughts, I guess, before we call it a case?
If they ever find this guy, I would love to know what the hell. Like,
prompted it?
Where did you even come up with that to begin with? And how and what and what? I mean, just so many questions, a million questions. So, but no, that's pretty much it for me.
That's about the same with me. I suppose on that note, Brandy, it was great working with you again. I know I only gave you about a week notice on this one. I was like, hey, why don't you do this case with me? You're like, wait, let me look at it. And then I sent it to you and you're like, yep, I'm in. It's like, okay, fucking go. You came.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
No, you came 110% prepared last time and you did not let me down this time. So thank you very much for joining me here.
Sure, absolutely.
All right. Well, I suppose then I will go ahead and say thank you again to Melinda for being that boots on the ground over there in Colorado and calling around and finding out that information for me. I appreciate it. But that aside, I suppose I'll see you guys on the flip side.
Thank you, Melinda.